So what I'm thinking is, since it's been a while, we'll just kind of let it, we'll let it flow, you know?
It'll we'll be just a little natural. Let it burn a little bit. Yeah.
Like, we could write an outline and have topics, but instead...
I've always learned that outlines usually lead me to not getting the paper finished.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Spend so much time on the outline, you don't ever write the paper.
That's just exactly wrong, but... It's been a while since we've recorded.
I not that I feel like I have to explain myself, but maybe I do. I've been pretty busy traveling and not really in the most Wi-Fi'd up areas.
Yeah.
Or as they say in some spots over here in the UK, the Wi-Fi.
Oh.
Yes, we have free Wi-Fi. But that's honestly, I have to say one of my biggest complaints about this country.
Mm-hmm.
Is how much they all love to charge for Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that's bizarro.
Yeah, like, okay, I went to the coffee shop the other day, Costa Coffee. It's like a chain Starbucks. I was like, oh, I'll be able to get some internet here. I buy my coffee, I sit down, and I can't connect to the internet. And I'm like, what the heck? So I go up to the counter, I'm like, hey, is there a way, or like the internet's not working? Like, oh, yeah, you need a card. So they had me a card, and I was like, okay, maybe they like to keep people from just coming in as bums.
Yep, makes sense.
Okay. No, it was the 30-minute Wi-Fi card.
Huh.
With the exchange rate, a $4 Americano, which is pretty subpar.
Wow.
And they couldn't throw in over 30 minutes of internet for
me. Yeah, okay. So I've heard of that happening. It's like you got you know, the quote free Wi-Fi because you made a purchase.
Yeah,
which is pretty normal. A lot of places around here will not a lot of places. Some places around here will do that. Or I went in this Indian restaurant the other day, and like they had the Wi-Fi password just written on a board, but it was like kind of in an awkward spot, and so you had to be like sitting at a table and you could see it, and then like, you couldn't see it like if you just walked in, which is whatever.
Yeah,
and. I know a lot of places will like have a password and they'll give out the password to customers, or like write it on your cup or something.
Yep.
But the idea there is that it's just, you have a password to the network and they can kind of control it so that it's not just bums coming in.
Yeah.
By bums, I don't mean homeless people. Usually it's like people that just don't want to pay for coffee. They buy one cup of coffee, but like 30 minutes, would you have expected an hour? Or 2 hours or 4 hours? Like, what time restriction would have been valid?
I guess I would have expected, like, I don't understand. I mean, I guess I feel like putting a time restriction on there is not necessary.
So I think the time restriction is not that, like, the asset of their, like, sharing an internet connection is expensive for them. It's that you take up space in the coffee shop. And if you have connection to the internet, you might be there for 2 hours
longer
with one $4 purchase versus, you know, if you leave after 30 minutes. They can sell that space. Because, I mean, coffee shops are essentially selling space and coffee, right? It's not just the coffee that they're selling.
Yeah, definitely. But the one that really got me, even worse than the coffee shop, because that's sort of justifiable, was we went down to London as a group. And so we stayed at, I would say, maybe 3.5 or 4-star hotel. Fairly nice hotel in downtown London.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the city, heart of the city there. Small rooms, but very nice, very clean. And they charged ridiculous prices for the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous. $15 with the exchange rate. And here's the kicker. It was a day of internet. And they got me on the first day because it was like 8 or 9 p.m. And so I assumed like a day.
You assumed it was like 24 hours.
24 hours. No, at midnight. My internet shut off, and then I would need to purchase a new day of internet.
What?
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty rough.
I was like, this is unacceptable. This is a whole lot of bogus.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. So again, to kind of explain why this happens, or my understanding of why this happens, I think cheaper hotels, and I don't have any idea like how to rate hotels by stars, so I'm thinking like $50 to $150 hotels per night, which are like, depending on where you are in the United States, that's either like the slummiest hotel at $50, or it's like, you know, if you're on a highway, maybe it's like a reasonable motel with like a bed that's probably had its sheets washed and like you kind of trust it and you're going to sleep there and it's fine.
Yeah. You're going to pull the top blanket off though.
Yeah. The reason they get, the reason they get or often have free Wi-Fi or free HBO or things like that is that people who are picking hotels at that price point actually compare the luxuries and make a decision based on what comes
based
with it.
That.
So if it's like,
that's
I'm
true.
Comparing two and it's like, here's one that's closer to the highway and it's $75 a night, or there's one that's further and it's 85, but it has, you know, a free breakfast.
And a pool.
And a pool and Wi-Fi. Then I'm going to go there. Like, this one has HBO, so I'll go here.
I guess the reason it like kind of surprises me is that like, if you go into a hotel in the States nowadays, if you go into any sort of public establishment nowadays, and they don't have Wi-Fi,
it's very weird.
You slap them in the face and you go to their competitor.
The thing I found in San Francisco is not Wi-Fi as much as power outlets. Coffee shops don't have much for power. And coming out of the Midwest, I was used to, you know, 2 years ago, maybe it was like, oh, I wonder if they're going to have free Wi-Fi or not, which is weird because they it seems like they should. But it was just kind of expected. Like, you bring your laptop and you maybe don't necessarily get a table with a power outlet right away, but for the most part, most tables have access to a power outlet. I don't know much about electricity prices, but I'd imagine that laptops are using a small amount of power, but not that small. And if you have, you know, 10 extra laptops plugged in all day, I can see how that could become expensive. But
yeah. But the other thing too is San Francisco is probably a little bit older in some of their buildings, so they might not have the wiring capabilities.
Yeah, I know some of them, like the coffee shop has outlets everywhere, but they're all taped over.
Oh.
And I mean, part of like me working as a technician, if I see a taped over outlet, I assume it's bad, or like,
yeah,
I'm like, let's not use the one with the tape over. But it's probably just that they don't want people to plug their laptops in. And maybe
again,
they don't want people to like stay there for 6 hours, you know?
Yeah, they want you to use that only one battery's worth of your day.
You know, it's kind of like the story of McDonald's chairs being designed to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, so that you don't hang out all day.
Which just seems foreign to me, because like, who goes to hang out at McDonald's?
Although now, have you been into a newer McDonald's?
I can't say that I have.
I went into one when I was on my way to the Twin Cities when I flew out. And it was a brand new McDonald's, and it looked like a cross between like a Starbucks and like a Chipotle.
Okay, I'm understanding.
Very nice, very trendy, comfortable feeling. Like, they had two couches, like really clean couches with like a end table and newspapers. And then I was like, I guess they sell coffee and stuff now, so they're trying to get that market of people that come and hang out and meet up at McDonald's.
I mean, it makes some sense. I know that the coffee at McDonald's and Burger King and some gas stations often compared to Starbucks in blind taste tests wins in the Pepsi style challenge. And you know, we talk about coffee a lot here. This might be a good time to do a plug for another show on the Verbmill Network. If the listeners are not familiar, we have more shows on verbmill.net, one of which is called Dwell On, and it's all about homes, and we've talked about it a bunch of times. I was actually lucky enough to be a guest on the most recent episode. I believe it's episode 26, A Fistful of Silverware. We'll link to that in the show notes. It's all about coffee, and it was planned to be like a 45-minute conversation about coffee, and it turned into like 2-hour conversation about coffee. Got trimmed down a little bit from there.
Got trimmed down a bit.
Yeah. Yeah,
but just one more thing to the listeners, make sure you listen to other episodes of Dwell On, because I'm just going to assume, I haven't listened to every episode, but I have to say that whenever Will goes on, it's probably going to be the worst episode.
Oh, no, my episode was the best episode.
I'm just kidding.
Well, the thing is, we sat down to record it.
Every podcast episode where Will is on, it's the worst episode. I'm glad that I'm co-hosting with you.
We sat down to record it. My brother, who is a host of that show, was in town, so we sat down next to each other to record. And the plan was to record the coffee episode, and then we were going to go do some other work-related things. And we started looking at their notes, and they had like 17 pages of follow-up notes. And so we recorded like a 45 or 50-minute episode of follow-up. And what? Then the coffee episode. So it's actually like, I mean,
3 hours of podcasting.
Yeah, which is just the reverse of this, because we joked when we sat down that like, oh, we could write some notes and plan this. But it's been so long that I think we kind of just want to catch up and kind of let everyone know what's going on.
Figure out where
so
we're
our
at.
Notes are one sentence long.
Our notes are catch up. It's just a bottle, actually. Just a bottle of ketchup.
Bottle of ketchup.
Some other... big news on my end. I started hosting a community radio station in England.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We kicked off our debut episode yesterday at 3 o'clock Greenwich Standard Time. And it's another student studying abroad and I. And the show, I don't know, we wanted to get on the air and kind of figure out how everything worked before we started deciding what the show was going to be about. But it's loosely going to be us talking about bands from the United States, specifically Midwest Minnesota, and talking about how what they're singing about or making music about is either connected to or not connected to life in Minnesota. So, yeah, if you're from Minnesota, it's probably not worth your time to listen to.
No, don't say that. You got to sell it high.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, the market's definitely here. That's why we're doing it here.
Yeah. Is it available online or in podcast form?
It's available online. I can't push it out on podcast because of licensing agreements.
Yeah.
But I will be able to link to, send you guys a link to listen to it. It's Lionheart Radio.
That's
the voice of Northumberland.
That's fantastic. You're actually playing music. What sort of, they have just paid the rights to broadcast it live and internet broadcasted, but not provided as downloadables?
They can't provide it as downloadables. They can broadcast it on, and there's a way that you can watch, that you can listen to old episodes that they're online.
Yeah.
But they're struggling with getting some of the technical difficulties ironed out with that, but.
That'll be streaming though, right? Like they won't provide a way to download it.
No, you won't be able to download it at all. And, but it's a pretty good show. Our first episode was a little rocky because we forgot that we were doing it until about 2:50 and we were both painting. And then we're like, oh crap, we have to get to the radio station, and like sprinted, the half mile to the radio station, ran up the three flights of stairs and walked into the booth. And we're like, okay, let's try to remember the training we had 2 weeks ago. And it went rather smoothly. We had some people listening in. We didn't tell a lot of people about the first one because we wanted to...
because you wanted to kind of iron out the kinks.
Yeah, float under the radar right away. But it went well. It went really well.
So other than this radio show, what have you been up to recently, Tom?
I took a little 10-day trip to Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. Belfast is where I flew into. If you guys know, Belfast is kind of a city that's known for some troubles and a lot of, like, you know, civil rights things going on within the Catholics and the Protestants. And so that was really interesting to kind of get to experience that. They had a really nice thing called the Black Taxi Tours. And it was £20, and you rode in the back of a black taxi, and they took you around the Shanghill neighborhoods, which is where kind of all the fighting took place and where they built the peace wall between the Catholic and the Protestant neighborhoods. So Northern Ireland had a fantastic tour, black taxi tour, learned all about the troubles from 1969 into the 90s and how those troubles are kind of coming back into light now. As a whole, though, Belfast was a really interesting city because of the kind of like sad history it had. It's having a really nice rebirth, it seems like. They have pretty low cheap property, a fair amount of like government interest in investing in grants and things. There's an area of the city called the Titanic Quarter, which is where they used to have a bunch of shipyards that have now obviously failed, and they're not building big ships anymore. And so they're in the process of renovating, and they've built a huge museum for the Titanic. And they're going to build a bunch of shops and things out on this beautiful, beautiful shipyard and kind of turn into this big tourist area. And it's going, it seems to be going really well. Also, there's a pretty big artist community in Belfast, especially with photography. That was kind of started with an organization called Belfast Exposed that run a lot of really nice photography shows in Belfast. And so it was really cool to see kind of that they're kind of seem to be coming out of that problem, and they're moving slowly, but in the right direction anyway. And then I took a bicycle trip. We got our bikes on the train and rode a couple hours on the train up to the North Coast, and then biked down the North Coast back to Belfast area. The bike that I was riding was very, very old. The back wheel was somewhat bent, and we rode probably far too many miles and on far too hilly of terrain for either of us. The guy I was traveling with was just a guy that I met up with when I was in Belfast. And I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. My butt has never been in so much pain as the second day of biking. It was just grueling. It's like the only thing I focused on was just like push one knee down. Okay, push the other knee down. Push the other knee down. Just kind of keep going. It was a very humbling experience, and a painful.
That sounds awful. That sounds terrible.
But yeah, the plane ride back to England, I was I wanted to ask for a donut seat on the plane. I didn't deliver a baby, but I would like a donut seat.
Yeah. It's maybe kind of obvious. The two pieces that stuck out to me from your story about Belfast was the low property values and kind of like cheap area that's trying to undergo a revival. So there is, you know, government spending there, and also kind of a boom of artists. Generally, that's like the beginning of the process of
gentrification.
It's not necessarily gentrification, though. At least not in the negative. Like, we're moving poor people further away from the places that poor people work, and like significantly harming thousands of lives. It's more of like an area that is depressed is being revived.
Although a lot of times. I guess this has been sort of something that I've been really interested in studying the last couple of months, is just the idea that I don't think that artists ever have the intention of gentrifying in a bad way.
No.
A lot of times it ends up being sort of the what ends up happening.
Yeah. I mean, there are positive and negative things from it altogether.
It goes too far.
But like
generally it's positive.
Cheap areas are nice for artists because artists don't have any money. So they move into the cheap areas, and like also like abandoned warehouses are really popular in like snobby apartment buildings now, but are also like really conducive to making art. So you get six friends together and you move into a crappy warehouse and you make some great art, and then property value increases because, you know, there's people there being productive. And generally, like, not that a lot of artists make it and become successful, but the ones that do, you know, it's pretty financially.
Keep it going.
Yeah, it's pretty financially successful, and like even failing galleries even bring money into the area.
Bring money, and even if you don't make enough to really make it, you bring in 50 to 100 artists into a 2-city block area. Then there's going to be people who can open up a coffee shop and a burrito shop, and they're going to eat there. You know
exactly. I've been looking, you know, around San Francisco at different areas, and there are tons of people talking about, like, you know, in 5 years, this is going to be the hip neighborhood. Or maybe they mean in 1 year, this is going to be the hip neighborhood.
Yeah.
And, like, some of the older, more established neighborhoods are still, like, maybe hip. Like, the Mission is kind of hip, but it's also not expensive. It's kind of gritty. You know, at night, there are lots of people on the street asking for money or, you know, kind of hanging out on the street, versus like some of the nice areas that maybe are, you know, kind of this hip, you know, but like at nighttime they're just dead quiet.
Yeah.
And there are some other more industrial areas that are up and coming. And so it's interesting to look at. It's interesting to see how artists are changing that. Yeah.
I guess one city, one area that I have my, my sights on, is Detroit. And I think everyone should kind of start looking there because there's been a huge move in. And the other, group besides artists that's moving to Detroit right now are urban farmers.
Hmm.
They're people who are turning factories into basically miniature organic farms with these kind of bizarro, hydroponic, almost organic ways of growing, and then collecting rainwater and creating irrigation systems within the factories. And right now, Detroit has already has more organic farms than any other city in the world, and they're exporting more organic produce than any other state.
Hmm. Wow.
So
wait. Michigan is exporting more organic produce than any other state.
That's maybe it's any other city.
It's got to be city because I be city. Can't see yeah. how Michigan can beat California for organic produce export.
That's true. That's true.
Although,
unless there's like some like
unless nobody in Michigan wants to buy organic produce, so it all gets exported.
Or there's like some weird like underlying thing in like. Lumber is like organic, so they're selling like exporting like tons of lumber from the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, are they deforesting that area? Maybe they are.
I don't know if anyone would care in the Upper Peninsula.
Oh, the Upper Peninsula is great, you know.
It is
20 feet of snowfall.
Yeah. Did you know that the Upper Peninsula is one of the only places in the world that imports garbage?
No.
Yeah. They Why? Take Toronto doesn't have anywhere to throw their garbage anymore. And so they sell it, like they ship it. Okay. It's cheaper for Toronto to ship their garbage to the Upper Peninsula. And then the Upper they like pay some sort of money to the Upper Peninsula.
Sense. Well, it's like Jersey takes it from New York, right?
Yep.
But yeah, that's just because they have a garbage fetish.
Yeah, it's just because they like living in garbage in Jersey. Oh, gross. That's because they are garbage. Let's put it the right way. But yeah, Michigan's... Machine's gonna get hot,
up and coming.
Be ready for that.
Certainly, there's some cool art things going on in the area because of
the cheap.
Well, I mean, part of it because it's cheap, but also because a lot of artists care about community. Amos Kennedy, who's a pretty well-known printmaker, letterpress printmaker, is in process of setting up kind of a letterpress school and studio where, like, come and like a co-op, basically, come and learn to print and print with us, and you know, that seems pretty cool. You can buy a warehouse for like $30,000. So
yeah, I found a small warehouse for $11,000.
$11,000.
Yeah, the back taxes on it were kind of a janky, but
Yeah, I suppose that's probably where they get you.
Yeah, snaggy on the back taxes, but you don't need to pay those anyway.
Yeah, because you're only gonna be there for 6 months.
Yeah, then you're just gonna
burn it to the ground. So
yeah, just gonna make a bunch of artwork and then take your artwork and burn the building to the ground.
Yeah.
So yeah, other things I've done, I guess, is I went to London for a week and then went down during that time to Brighton, the city of Brighton, for 2 days, which is sort of popularly known as the San Francisco of the United Kingdom.
Yep.
And I guess I haven't been to San Francisco in the United States, but the stereotype of a fun, loving... open, exciting, young city definitely came through for Brighton. It was fantastic. They had amazing live music, really good food, cheap food.
So not San Francisco then.
No, it's a little... I could have found more expensive food, but they also had, you know, cheap, you know, younger food bars and restaurants for my sort of demographic. And then right by the English Channel there. So nice little beach.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was great. The other thing I guess that really got me as an artist, as a student of art, is in London we got to hit up the Tate Modern, the Tate Britain, the National Gallery, the Saatchi Gallery, and the Tate Modern was one of the coolest things I think I've ever seen in my entire life. Just everything that was in there, everything that... like surrounded it, the building itself, pretty fantastic. But an area where I kind of felt like an idiot, I had like an aha moment, was when we went to the National Gallery and we went in to look at some Jan van Eyck paintings. And we looked at the man in the red turban, where they think it might be a self-portrait of him. That painting is like a 4x6 inch painting.
Huh.
It's just tiny.
Yeah.
It's a very small painting. And it has this really nice intricate gold frame that surrounds the whole thing that I never knew existed. And I was just like, wow, that was, I always kind of thought it was like, you know, at least,
well, you see in art history projections, it's like 8 feet by 10 feet, right?
Yeah. And on the frame, there's the motto, Ich act ax, which is Latin for I do as I can, which I never knew was on this frame, but it was kind of a neat little thing to look at, especially with the idea that this might be a self-portrait. That little saying, I do as I can. So that was cool to see. Got to see some, you know, Hans Holbein, just everything. It was quite overwhelming, actually, to see everything. The other big thing that stood out to me, and I don't know if it was even done intentionally, but we went to the Tate Britain, and I went into the 1960s wing, and they had sort of a conceptual art room. And on the wall, there was an empty frame and a little note card in it that said, artwork removed. And it said, piece of artwork, or title of artwork, a line that I made walking in the grass, artist Richard Long. And then it said, removed, or area that it was removed to. And it said, gallery 46. And so then I continue walking through the gallery. I get to gallery 46. And it is part of another show that they were putting on. And it seems sort of out of place. And so I don't know if it was like a curator like pulling a, like a joke, because I don't know if anybody knows Richard Long, but a lot of his artwork was about these walks he would take and these little like trips he would do and things he would do with walking. And it was so cool to have to walk to a Richard Long piece. I don't know. It was a pretty fantastic way to view the piece, whether it was intentional or not.
It's got to be intentional. There's no way to make that mistake. Right?
Yeah, it's got to be like, because I don't really know. I guess the other show that it was a part of, he sort of made sense that he was in that show, but not really enough that you'd pull him out of a gallery three rooms away to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah. A very smart little thing to do, I think.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So
really pleased to see that. Also, there was a show at the Tate Britain, or at the Tate Modern, I'm sorry, called a bigger splash, all about painting after performance art became a thing. And my favorite part was they had a little projection of Jackson Pollock and how he paints. And then they had one of his paintings on the ground, like he would paint them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of cool to view his artwork like that.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of his artwork.
Okay.
It was just, if I'm viewing it, it's always made sense that it should be on the floor.
I don't know if I agree with that. Why should it be on the floor? Because that's how he made it?
Yeah, well,
You don't have to display other paintings on easels or...
No, but I mean, the whole idea behind his art, his, like, painting is that, like, I throw stuff on the floor.
That's well, not the
like
whole
throw it
idea.
On the wall. Throw it on the wall, dude.
No, you can't, because it drips differently. Then you don't want runs, so that's why you put it on the floor, right? Is that
yeah? Like, but then I think
the paint
that,
falls where it falls and it doesn't run around.
Yeah, and well, I guess to me the reason I like looking on the ground like that then is as soon as you put it up on the wall, there's a maybe I don't know if the word is like people sort of become impressed, a little overly impressed with how the paint falls. Because it's looks differently. Like if you nobody gets to see how something would look at, you know, like if you spill on the floor. If you spill on the floor, if you could get that spill to look on the wall, it would automatically become more impressive than it is on the floor.
Well, yeah, but if you put anything on a gallery wall, it's automatically more impressive.
Well, no, no, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying, like, a gallery wall, even. No, like, if you...
And I understand that, but, like, with Pollock's work, the...
Yeah.
I think it kind of necessitates that perception change, where it was on the floor and you put it on the wall, because now it doesn't look natural. Whereas, like, if it's on the floor, then it actually just looks like a drop cloth for a painting room. And if it's on the wall, now it looks like this intentional act.
It's an intentional act of painting.
And, like, I can agree it might be fun to see it on the floor, or, like, interesting to do that, but that's not how those should be presented. That's not, like, in mass, everybody should go out and put their Pollock on the floor now.
No. No,
because like, that is kind of counterintuitive for what the piece is.
To a point, I guess. But he also had that whole... he wanted everything to seem so natural and visceral and everything else, and how he made his work, and everything was just him, this is how it lands, paints where it lands, and leave it where it lands.
I mean, at some level, then, like, if you're talking about paint as a paint, it should just display paint in tubes or paint in cans, right? Like,
I guess if you want to go that far. I think that it becomes interesting when you find the line where it still is interesting.
I can talk about paint's it. Interesting.
Put a can of paint on the wall then.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, it was a good week in London. A lot of cool stuff to see. Tour of Parliament, which is a lot. The House of Commons, if anybody's watched C-SPAN for Questions with the Prime Minister, which you all should, because it's one of the silliest forms of modern government. It's a bunch of dudes just yelling at each other across a room.
Is that the one where to ask a question they have to stand up and put one hand on their head and one hand out?
Yeah, they do like some weird thing with their hand, and then as soon as somebody asks a question, like the opposing party, like everyone in the back row of the opposing party just basically like yells to try to like muffle the question, like, and it's just like yelling, just so much yelling. And then like while the Prime Minister is speaking, people who agree with him are like cheering, and people who disagree are like booing him. But it was the interesting part of that room was it was a lot smaller than it looks like on TV. And so it's probably even louder in real life to sit in that chaotic little den.
Yeah. I decided to quit my college parliamentary debate team pretty early on because...
When you realize I'm never going to get a girlfriend.
No, I was never worried about that, Tom. You just resigned yourself to that fact, and that's fine.
I knew it wasn't going to get a girlfriend before I got to college.
So you could do either way. For a point of order, you could, or for a question, you could do either way. The like British parliamentary style, which is like stand up, and I think it's like left arm out. And this is like you're doing the YMCA. You do the YMCA you do a Y with your left arm and an M with your right arm. That's what it is. So it's not like forward and then back. Yeah. It's like to the side. And you could also probably just stand. You probably didn't actually have to do that, the rigmarole. But there was protected time during every debater's speaking time. Like, you know, if you're speaking for 4 minutes or 5 minutes, your first minute and your last 30 seconds are protected time so that you can't be derailed during your opening statement or your closing argument. But you could still raise points of order during that time. And the point of order that I raised was that the debater used a racial slur in the first two sentences of his. And it was just like, well, it was like my teammate, right? Like, this was a practice. And then he got all upset that I was asking a question. And I was like, no, this is a point of order that it's not okay. And then
I was like, point of order that you're racist.
Like, I'm not coming back to this. God, what a thing. What a thing.
What a good thing to quit.
Yeah.
It's always nice when you can look back at good things you quit.
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't stick with it. The coach was a cool guy, and I liked him, and he was smart. And the team I did not really get along with.
Yeah.
And that was actually how we met, right? Because like I quit that, and then I started coaching a high school speech team.
Yeah. That's how Will and I met.
Which is better than coaching a college team, which is essentially what I was doing because I had to get the competitors to realize that they couldn't just
to realize that they were being racist
during official debate. I am very happy that Tom was able to get back on the internet and we are able to record this episode of the White Horse Courier.
Yeah, I am as well. It's awesome to be back. Hope to be back soon.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we love feedback. And so if you want to hit us on Twitter, I'm at Will Imholt.
And I'm at Tom Wixo.
You can also check us out at verbmill.net/thewhitehorsecourier.
Yeah, and for sure hit us up if you've seen some big advertising things going on the last month or two that we've missed out on.
Yeah, yeah, we've got a list of stuff to start talking about. But if you want to get your idea on that list, you know, send it to us there or send us an email or whatever.
Yeah, sounds good.
Cool. I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Only one more day, me Johnny, one more day.
Rock and roll me over one more day.
Can't you hear the old men growling?
One more day.
Oh, can't you hear the maid howling?
One more day. Oh. One more day, Johnny, one more day. Rock and roll me over one more day.
Can't you hear the captain calling?
One more day.
Can't you hear the barmaids calling?
One more day. One more day, Johnny. One more day. Rock and roll me over one more day.
Only one more day, calling.
One more day.
Can't you hear the pilot calling?
One more day. One more day, Johnny, one more day. Rock and roll me over one more day.
Oh, pull out your long-tailed coat, me Johnny.
One more day.
Make your board and take your dough, me Johnny.
One more day. One more day, Johnny, one more day. Rock and roll me over one more day.
Pack your bags today, me Johnny.
One more day.
And leave her where she lays, me Johnny.
One more day. One more day, Johnny. One more day. Rock and roll me over. One more day. One more day, Johnny. One more day. Rock and roll me over. One more day.
I stayed with some couch surfers, very nice guys. And the one guy that I met on couch surfing, he said he was a graduate student of English in London. He had a very tight space and you wouldn't be able to sleep in your own room. I was like, okay, that's fine. So I stayed, met up with them. We did a nice walk of the city, went to this great Thai restaurant, went back to their place. It was a two bedroom, which each two bedrooms were tiny. A tiny, tiny bathroom with a little shower. You could hardly, like, close the door and poop at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then a kitchen that was about as small as the bathroom. And then a living room. And the one bedroom was divided into four little desk areas. Because his three roommates... So he lived in this place with three other guys.
Wow.
So his three roommates were other grad students studying other things. So they all had their desks and study areas. And then the second bedroom had a bunch of dressers... And, like, the table to eat at. And then there was two couches and, like, a futon. And then a TV in the main room. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like, okay, like, where do you sleep? And he was like, oh, you can sleep on the futon. I was like, all right. So I throw my sleeping stuff out on the futon. And then they pull out both the couches. And they just have, like, a pile of blankets stacked up, and they just all, like, hop into a futon. Like, this weird sort of, like, hippie commune style of living.
Yeah.
And then it got really funny when I was kind of – we were talking about it, and they're laughing about their living arrangement and high rent in London and being a grad student and all these funny things. And I said, yeah. I said, this is pretty cool, like, very laid back. But how do you guys, you know –
entertain
the ladies in the bedroom. And the one guy that was sleeping closest to me, on like kind of right next to me on the like the futon and the little space, and then his bed, he just rolls over, looks me right in the eyes, and goes, "We invite a couch surfer over, and we all take a turn." I was like, "This would have been way funnier if I wasn't about to fall asleep in your apartment."